It's the 25th, and on Tuesday, we reviewed bond calculations. We did worksheet number two. We did the convertible securities worksheets. And so on this Tuesday... So this Tuesday, which is the 30th of April, you have to excuse me, I'm a little tired today. We're going to do chapters 9 and 10 on bonds, and then there may be one or two real generic questions on convertible securities, folks. Very generic. None of the calculations. All the calcs will be on bonds. And then today we're going to do asset allocation, chapter 11, and we'll burn through that. So make sure you have the Scantron, not a pencil. You need your calculator, the formula sheets for chapter 10 and chapter 6, because we probably will do, maybe, not quite sure, at least one constant perpetual and one discounted cash flow. So those are due. I mean, that's what's due. And if we have time, we'll go over yet another example. But today, first of all, let's take a look. How are we doing? Not bad, not bad. Apple and Caterpillar are dragging us down. And Procter & Gamble took a big hit yesterday because their earnings were not spectacular. But still, they went from up 14% to up just 10%. Look at Toyota, yuck. Coca-Cola, very good. So 6% for a few months is pretty darn good, folks. Pretty darn good. But I think Apple's still going to turn around. I don't know much about Caterpillar. But these companies are global, so you have to really be able to see how Caterpillar sells far more equipment outside the United States, because in the developing markets, they're growing a whole lot faster, so they need earth-moving equipment. So you really have to be able to see what's going on in those markets. Oh, don't forget one page of notes, as usual. One page of notes. Questions? Chapters 9 and 10 on bonds. Boring old bonds. And then maybe one or two questions on convertible securities. Very generic. In other words, what is a convertible security? The ability to move from a debt or preferred stock bond or preferred stock into common stock. Just generic questions. And then today we're going to do with asset allocation. And so let's get started on asset allocation, because here is where we tie everything together, folks. And I always say that, and I feel badly, because I had a class once, and this was a math, an undergraduate degree, and we had a professor, nobody could understand what the hell he was trying to get us to do, let alone figure out the problems he would give us. And at the very end, near the end of the semester, he said, well, now we're going to tie it all together, and hopefully it'll all make sense. And after the lecture, we all looked at each other. You know what the hell he was talking about? No. Oh, joke! We forgot the joke! I can't believe we forgot the joke! Okay. I told you about Mrs. Wiggins, right, in the hospital, right? Yeah. I think I did. Well, how about the three junkies? Now, you three heroin addicts, we're sharing needles. And their buddy came up to him and said, I told you guys, don't do that! You can get AIDS that way! And they said, no, it's cool. We're all wearing condoms.
See, they're going to wear condoms.
What? It's dirty? You think so? It's dumb. So what? You thought that was dumb? Okay. Well, we got cannibal jokes, which are really sick. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to tie it all together. Because, folks, we're finished. We are basically finished this semester. You now know the most important, if you were studying, I'm aware, during this semester, investment alternatives. And we're going to tie them all together in diversification, risky asset allocation. Now, after exam number 4, we're going to do some odds and ends, which you need to know, if only to know why you should stay away from them. Shorting, margins, futures, and the like. So let's get started on what the book calls diversification and risky asset allocation. I wouldn't use the word risk. I would just say asset allocation. There are risks with every type of investment. Doesn't matter what they are. Even if there's no risk of default, there are still inflation risk and opportunity cost risk. So what's diversification? Spreading your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all of the risks of investing, because you can't get rid of all the risks. There are always risks. You've heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? Don't put all your eggs in one... You've heard that saying? Nod your head yet. Yeah. Maybe you haven't, I don't know. As opposed to put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. And it's attributed to Mark Twain and a few other people, but it's a cute quote. Put all your eggs in, watch the basket. And if it falls, it, well, you're watching it. So, over the long sweep of time, and here we go from 1987 to 2011, diversification has been one of the best methods to reduce risk. So, Fernando, could you do your little thing on the right-hand side down twice? Because it's hard to see. But the asset class that is in blue is the one that did the best. And notice that very rarely is the United States the best market in the world, except for that stretch in the late 90s when our stock markets went hyperkinetic. Look at how well the emerging markets have done over the last 25 years. But don't bother to look at the times when they fell 25 and 30 and 50 and 18%. Yeah, volatility. But never, never in that one time has cash been the best investment alternative. So you may be tempted to pick up your money and move it into cash, worried about the stock market falling. And you may get it right. I don't think you will, but you then got to get it right to go the other way. When has it fallen far enough? So I think this really shows that you need to be properly diversified and just live with it, deal with the risk. And if the world falls apart, oh well. How do we measure risk? Well, we've come full circle. Would you rather leave the lights on?
No.
Off? Off? It's easier for you to go to sleep? Way back, remember way back in January, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return. Risk and return. There ain't no way to get around it. We saw how higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation, and it's a companion measure variance from the average annual return. You want high return? You're going to get high risk. We've studied the major financial asset classes, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, cash. We discussed the risk and returns of each. We found that return is relatively easy to measure. How much did you start with? How much did you make? How long did it take you? You measure that. It's very easy. But it's very difficult to measure risk. And it's almost impossible, or not impossible, but it's very difficult to anticipate. Witness 2008. Folks, I was sure the market was going to fall, but I didn't think it was going to be anywhere near as bad as it was. But hey, how would you know? Variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. These measures are readily available from the investment community. You go online, and that's part of your assignment for Chapter 11. Very simple. You're just going to look up some standard deviations. And the numbers ain't pretty. For any randomly selected on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is almost 50%, which means it'll vary 50% up and down from its average annual return. Now, this is one randomly selected stock. Obviously, if you happen to select Procter & Gamble, or Johnson & Johnson, the standard deviation is going to be less than if you pick a Nokia or somebody else is more volatile. That means in any one year, as I said, many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange will vary up or down close to 50%. So how can we reduce the variance? In other words, how do we reduce the risk? The answer, of course, is to diversify. You just don't buy one stock. You go from one randomly selected stock to two randomly selected stocks, and the standard deviation goes down from 49.2% down to 37%. If you go to 10, it goes to 24%. 20, 21.8%. By diversifying our stock portfolio, it reduces our risk substantially as measured by standard deviation and variance, which we've already acknowledged are imperfect measures. Right? Okay, good. Now, this is a graph that's, or a table that's from the book. You see, as the number of stocks in the portfolio grows, you see the standard deviation going down. Right? But what happens here? Wait a minute. It goes from 49 to 37 to 26 to 25 to 24. What's going on here? We're adding many more stocks, but the standard deviation is not going down very fast, is it? Do you know what that's called in math? Do you know what that's called? Well, this is the curve. That's the limit. Have you heard of the limit? As you... That's it. We can't get much lower than that. We can add another 1,000 stocks and we still are stuck at 19%. It's called limit. Limit theory. Remember, you've ever taken calculus? The limit as the number of little slivers gets to zero. Yeah. Same idea. It could be infinity. It's the same. It's the old joke of there were two the applied mathematician and the theoretical mathematician. I don't know if you want to hear a math joke. No, I'm a math major. Can you hear a math joke? Okay, there's this beautiful naked woman at the end of the hallway. Beautiful. And they tell the theoretical mathematicians that you can walk toward her, but every step you take has to be one half the size of the other step. Right? One half the time. And so the theoretical mathematicians say, well, we can't get there. And the applied mathematicians say, yeah, we can't get there, but we can get close enough. Alright, so here, there's a limit to which diversification. See, if you got a math, you got to be a math guy to, or a gal to like the math. But there is a. What?
It's not a perfect measure.
It's not a perfect measure. Exactly. As long as you get close enough. There is a limit to which diversification can reduce your risk in any given asset class. In this case, stocks. Why is that? It's called correlation. I want you to learn this word, even though you're not going to use it unless you're trying to impress somebody at a party. It's called correlation. And we've used this term before in certain instances. The insurance companies love it. They look for correlations all the time. It's not necessarily causality. It's correlation. The tendency of the returns of two asset classes to move together. Imperfect correlation is the key reason why diversification reduces portfolio risk as measured by the portfolio standard deviation. So if two items are perfectly correlated, that means they're going to move in the same direction at the same time. But there are no such things. Now, one stock might do really, really well, the other one might do a little bit poorly, and then the others come back. If one's a defensive and one's a growth stock. So no two investment returns will be exactly the same. If something is positively correlated, that means they move together. If something is negatively correlated, that means they move in the opposite direction. And then some things may be neutral or no correlation. Did I spell it right? Neutral? Yeah. No correlation. That means one moves up, the other one moves up, one moves down, the other one moves off. They don't follow one another. And we can compute that. We compute that with what is called the correlation coefficient. It sounds like math. Well, really, all it is a number between negative 1 or negative 100% up to 0 or 0% and then up to plus 1 or 100%. So if something is positively correlated, it'll be greater than 0. And the closer it is to 100%, the more they'll move together. If something is negatively correlated, it'll be negative 0, between 0 and negative 1. And if it hits negative 100%, negative 1, that means they move in exactly the opposite directions. Does that make sense? It sounds a little, you know, highfalutin. It's just part of statistics. But here are three examples. And they're not really the best graphs, especially the third one. But here are two, they use security A and security B, two stocks, two bonds, whatever they are. And these are positively correlated. In fact, they're perfect correlation, meaning 100%. They both go in the same direction. Right? Now, one goes up a little higher, one goes a little lower, but they go in the same direction at the same time. Whereas these two are negatively correlated, perfectly negatively correlated, because one goes up, the other one goes down. That one goes back down, the other one goes back up. Are you with me? And then this one, which isn't actually the best graph, but it's there, is trying to show you that they're completely unrelated. So this would be a correlation coefficient of zero. It's neutral. Right? Make sense? Okay, very good. So how does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risks of owning stocks? Because although stocks are not perfectly correlated, they are positively correlated enough so stocks in general tend to move in the same direction. This is why we often hear the stock investments as a whole as the stock market. How's the market doing? Well, I mean, the market is thousands of stocks. Well, the stocks tend to move together. If the economy is doing well, stocks in general will rise. Now, a few of them are going to be falling by the wayside, you know, whatever technology or some other company just destroys them out in the marketplace. At any given time, some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and many are simply chugging along, as they always have done, but they tend to move together. Make sense? Good. Darn. I can add 1,000 stocks, and it's not going to reduce my risk any more than if I just had 50 or 40 or even 30. Well, 30 would be a little better. That's too much risk for me. I think I'm going to stick to bonds. You are a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and you don't like the volatility of stocks. Therefore, you decide to place all your investments into bonds. You will accept the lower return from bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops. That's not a good idea. Exactly, because like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. Bonds go up and down in relation to interest rates. Interest rates go down, bond prices. Interest rates go up, bond prices go down. And it turns out that when interest rates go down and bond prices go up, that's usually because the market, the economy is faltering. And interest rates are falling because the demand for money is less, and the Federal Reserve Bank is often trying to inject money into the system by lowering interest rates. And so that means the stock market's tanking. Well, bonds are doing well. And if the interest rates are rising because the economy is getting stronger, there's more demand for money, the Federal Reserve Bank might be trying to cool the economy by raising short-term interest rates, stocks are probably doing really, really well. And what happens to bonds when interest rates rise? Bonds fall. So bonds are positively correlated with themselves. And as they said, they also tend to do well and do poorly as a whole. And they are often negatively correlated with stocks.
So when stocks are doing good, bonds are bad?
Not always. It's not perfect. I'm sorry, perfect negative. It's still imperfect. Sometimes stocks and bonds do well together. In 2008, stocks went down, bonds went down, except for treasury bonds. Treasury bonds did well. What? 2007, stocks were still doing really well. Bonds were sort of just, they were just hanging around. Yeah, as I remember, I got to go back and take a closer look at them. But we can go back and look. Let's go back and look. How did stocks do in 07? Okay, here's 07. Stocks did international stocks did well. Emerging markets exploded. And bonds actually did better than the stock market. Good, okay. So, but they both did okay, not fabulous.
All right, so there's what I said. But 08,
let's go back to 08, which was a mess. So we went down third. That's the S&P 500, by the way. S&P 500, international, global, actually did worse. International did about the same. And emerging markets did even worse. But U.S. bonds did the best. International bonds held up. Now, if they had showed, they're not showing corporate bonds here. Corporate bonds got hammered. Corporate bonds got killed. And, of course, cash didn't do very well because the Federal Reserve Bank and many banks around the developed world lowered interest rates dramatically in 2008. And then they... and then, look... Okay, so where the hell were we? Where the hell were we? Okay. All right, so here we are. This is a graph that may or may not click with you again if you hate math. But what it's showing you is return, our expected return, our average annual return over years, and our standard deviation. And we see that stocks have the highest standard deviation, and they have the highest return. Which make, we knew that, right? We already knew that. And as we add bonds to the mix, what happens is our return comes down and our standard deviation comes down. Our measure of risk, imperfect as it is. Until finally, we've lowered the stock portfolio, we've raised the bond portfolio to the point where we've hit the lowest amount of standard deviation, and we keep adding bonds, our return goes down, which you'd expect because bonds return less, but now our standard deviation goes back up. You see what's happening? Because bonds are correlated with, positively correlated with themselves, we keep adding bonds to the portfolio, our return goes down as we would expect. We would expect returns to go down. But our standard deviation goes up. Our measure of risk, our imperfect measure of risk. So this is why balanced funds are a great choice for people who are terrified of markets. Because, you know, when the stock market's screaming, the balanced fund is going to have those bonds in it, which are going to keep it, you know, sort of dragging behind. What? Yeah, you got the good and bad of both worlds. But when the stock market tanks, the bond portfolio will often, but not always, hold up the entire mutual fund to the point where, hey, you know, I lost 10%, 20%, but my buddy over there lost 50, 60%. You understand? Now, if you're the kind of person who doesn't want to lose a dime, you're in the wrong classroom. Because it's going to happen, you know, it's going to happen. In fact, one of you, there's, anybody missed Tuesday? Pass it around. The Baffle the Brokers. I got some great questions in this class. Great questions. One of you asked me, what's the most amount I've lost in a day? And I was thinking, wow, great question. Now, that's going to take me a while. I've got to go back through all the... I figure it's got to be in 2008. If I were to guess, well, I would think it would about be about 7.5%, because that's the one day, the biggest loss in 2008 was about a little over 7%. So I'm thinking that's the day. I'll go if I can find that day. But I'll find out. And I'll tell you. Okay, now here's... What? I don't say anything. See, yeah. See, there's some people you just don't tell them. You just don't... Well, she knew. I mean, she knew we were losing money, but I think I told you this. When the market's falling, what I do with my clients and my friends and my family, I'll have this conversation. It's called walk them off the ledge conversation, you know, because they're ready to jump. Right? No more. I don't want any more. And you say, no, these are good opportunities if we believe that the global economy is going to prosper and we're all going to be well-fed and well-clothed and well-sheltered. Now's the time we should be putting more money in, or at least just continuing our contributions. I just go through that. And when you hear, when you talk to somebody and they say, oh, I don't even look at it, you go, oh, great. That's the best person. If you're like, oh, I lost $40, and then last week I lost $70. I'm like, oh, geez.
You need a balance fund. You need a balance fund. Because it's going to happen.
And here's the same graph. This is the graph in table form. Here, they should have put percentages. But here's 100% stock, 0% bonds. And then 100% bonds, 0% stock. And as we decrease the amount of stocks and increase the amount of bonds, we see our return falling. And it continues to fall until we hit bottom here. And we see our standard deviation falling, 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 slow, more slowly, until we get to about right here. And then it turns back and starts going up because of the positive correlation of bonds. Make sense? Well, you know, some people put the sweet spot here at 60-40. You will often hear that. You will often hear balance funds stay at about 60-40. It's a balance fund. It's what it's supposed to do. Now, I told you about the one balance fund. It's one of the oldest in the nation. It will never be below 50-50. It will never have less than 50% bonds, 50% stocks. And it will never have more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds. It will stay like that. And that's not atypical. That's fairly typical of balance funds. You have to be careful, because along with balance funds are asset allocation funds. They are often thrown in the same pot, asset allocation funds and balance funds. But asset allocation funds are very different depending on the manager. An asset allocation fund might say, oh, we're going to go 100% stocks, 0% bonds. Or we're going to go 0% stocks, 100% bonds. Or we're going to just walk out and just put everything in cash. Now that, to me, is market timing. And there are probably some people in this world who can do it. But the famous quote is from a very famous investor from the mid-20th century who said, don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. You know, this the same people who caught the really big fish that... By the way. Okay. All right. So a combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk while earning you more return than just bonds. How are we doing for time? Not bad. If you are seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, have several stocks, some defensive, some growth, some cyclical. It also pays to diversify amongst asset classes. So we want to have some stocks, want some bonds. And most of you eventually are going to want to buy a house, right? You'll have some real estate. And the cool thing about a house is you get to live in it. You don't get to live in a mutual fund. The same kind of relationship occurs with domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, although much less now than in the past. It used to be when the United States market would be jumping up and down. Europe would be in the doldrums, and Asia, who knows what they were doing. But now the markets around the world are more and more in lockstep, because many of the companies in the United States, the biggest ones, they make most of their money outside the United States, and many companies from outside the United States make a lot of their money inside the United States. So the companies are all global. Diversification, though, is still not a guarantee of positive results. Everybody got hammered in 2008. Everybody. And we have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called asset allocation. It's a fancy term for how much should I have in stocks, how much should I have in bonds, how much of each stock, how much of each bond type. Now, you are going to hear this formula. It's a very old formula. It's changing. And then we talk about it in the 121 clip. You take your age and subtract it from 100. So you millennials, you know, 20s, let's say we have a 40-year-old person. That's the example I used. If we have a 40-year-old person, you subtract 100 minus 40, and you wind up with 60. So you should be 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds. If you're 20 years old, 80% in stocks, 20% in bonds. If you're 60, 40% in stocks. You understand? Now, no?
Yeah.
So now, what happens?
is that as you get older, you're going to be reducing your stock portfolio and increasing your bond portfolio.
Why?
Because less risk. You are getting closer and closer to your retirement, and you need to be more protected against large losses. Because if it falls 50%, it's got to go back up 100% just to get back to where you started from. Right? But what you notice is that the number's been raised. You hear people now saying 110 and 120. Why is that? It's because people are living far longer. And so you even when you're 60 years old, 70 years old, you need some growth because you're going to be living another 20, 30 years. You millennials, if you don't live 100, it means that the trends have changed dramatically. It reminds me, what?
McDonald's.
Yeah, well, that we know. You know, we know it kills people. I got a really angry response from one of my 121 students when I said, well, you know, meat, it tastes good, and 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago was really important for us, but we didn't live that long then. Now, if you really want to live a long time, you got to reduce your meat consumption. And he goes, no, I'm not going to. I said, fine. No problem. It's your choice. Okay, so here's what other people say, and I'm one of these. Poppycock, right? Forget it. Buy all quality stocks and put up with the risk. Once you're near retirement, start buying bonds, but you don't want to give up on stocks, as we'll take a look at some hypothetical illustrations. There's another part of this called rebalancing. I'm not sure where it is. Okay, it's on the next one. Here, rebalancing. Okay, but here I did the asset allocation first. So this is just an example, folks. I'm not saying do this. I'm just saying here's just one example. It wouldn't be my example, depending on how old you are. You have to look at somebody else's. You have to decide for yourself. $100,000. So $100,000 gets dropped in your lap. And you're a prudent, risk-averse investor. Let's put, but you're young, 25% in bonds, 75% in stocks. You got it? Relatively, you know, it's fairly aggressive, but it's got some bonds. So $15,000 in high-grade corporate bonds, government bonds. There's a little bit of spice, the junk bonds, and some global. And then the stocks, 25,000 domestic growth and income, 25,000 global growth and income. You think I'm a growth and income kind of guy? Okay. 10% aggressive growth. There's a little bit of spice, international, spicy, and then the small company bonds. Somebody wants small company bonds. Give it to them. What do you think? Comments? Criticisms? Is it too risky for you? Too conservative?
Why do you want the company?
Too risky or not? I would take the small companies away and just have 15 to 5 to the aggressive.
Just another 5 to the aggressive growth? Why do we want, what'd you say?
Why do you want high yield bonds? Why not just take that 5,000 and get more stocks?
More stuff. That's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Okay? That's what I'm saying. This is just this is just one example. And what did you ask?
Is it not too risky, like sending 75,000 on stocks?
Is it?
No, I'm just asking.
Well, it's up to you. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Ask your, please say.
Oh yeah, it's up to the person whether they want to allocate 25,000 or 20,000.
For somebody who's 25 years old, right, 25% in bonds, 75% in stock, I think this is way too conservative, to be truthful. I mean, you don't need any bonds when you're that young, in my humble opinion. Other people would go, I don't know what he's talking about. Of course, everybody needs bonds. And maybe put a little bit in cash. Why would you want everything? I mean, if you need it for, this is for a long term. This is for 5, 10, 20 years. If you need it for the next 3 months, this is not where you put your money, right? Everybody nod their heads, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Don't go back and put your $50,000 into stocks that your mom gave you for the down payment on the house in 3 months, and then the stock market drops 20%. For whatever reason, and go, this is my hair, darling, you're putting it on, it's done. Some of those same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest the technique of what is called rebalancing. And you know, this makes a whole lot of sense. Each year you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. So say stocks have had a really good year. And let's see, it's a different color. Stocks have done a really good year, and you now have 70% stocks, and now you have 30% bonds. So what do? You, at the once a year, don't do this every month, or maybe twice a year, you sell some stocks, buy some bonds, to get you back into that 60-40 ratio. Are you with me? You see? In fact, many mutual fund companies are offering this as a service online. You go online and say, I want to rebalance my portfolio. You have to tell them what my asset allocation is. I want this percentage in stocks, this percentage in bonds, this much in cash, and then press a few buttons, and boom, the system does it for you. So, yeah, cool. This forces you to do the right thing. Because stocks have done well, you're selling. Because bonds have not done so well, or maybe they've done poorly, or they just didn't do as well as stocks, you're buying. You're buying low, selling high. You understand? Who wants to sell when stocks are going up, 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 up? Right? Everybody else is telling you how great they did. Do you want to sell?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, good. I found my job, right? Okay. Many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. The only problem is people are living much, much longer. The statistic I've read, and this was a few years ago, a 50-year-old living today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old. The fastest growing percentages of the population are those over 80, 90, and 100. As a percentage of the population, fastest growing. I mean, it's still far fewer than younger. As you near retirement, start migrating your investments from stocks to bonds, but don't abandon stocks entirely. And I don't know if you remember, we took a look way back in chapter 4. We'll take a look at some illustrations. Well, by 75, they really need to be having some, at least, at the very least, balanced funds. They need more balanced funds, they need more equity income, and they need some bonds. They definitely need some bonds. Now, right now, I would steer them, I don't know if this they'll be interested, but personally, I would steer them toward a global balanced fund and a global bond fund. Because right now, bonds in the United States scare me, personally. Personally, I would not want to recommend them. Especially if somebody was 75, because they only have about a 20-year time horizon. Well, maybe not, depends on their health. But if you look at the, if you make it to 75, you've got a good chance of making it to 90, depending on your health. But yeah, you have a very good chance of making it to 90.
What's your final question on this?
Well, it depends. It depends. If you buy a house, you buy a house, or if you whatever. But what I recommend to people, and what I'm thinking, is that when you go into retirement, you start withdrawing. You've been accumulating it. Now you start living off of it. And especially if you hate your job. If you hate your job, you can't wait to retire. Then you start pulling the money out. And we're going to take a look at some illustrations. If you guys stay awake, I'll show it to you. Now, do you remember dollar cost averaging? Hopefully now it's going to make a whole lot more sense. It's a system of buying an investment at regular intervals at fixed dollar amount. With dollar cost averaging, there is always good news. The market is up. Good news. Come on, wake up. I know the lights are off. The market's up. Good news.
Yippee.
Yippee. Your account is worth more. The market's down. Good news. Yes. If you have a long-term perspective, a down market is a godsend. Because everything is on sale. Next month, if you depending on how much money you're putting away, $50, $100 a month, comes out of your paycheck or checking account.
I have a question.
About the question.
Yeah, for example, you're in American fund, so to the people that are giving their $50 or $100, they're like buying shares.
Right, they're
when the market stops.
Right, exactly. You're giving your, whether you're buying the shares yourself in your own account or you're buying a mutual fund, the mutual fund company, if they're good, if they're smart, are continually buying, especially when they believe shares are low.
It's minus
what? Yeah, that's you want them to do that. You don't want, hey, it's up to you. But I would not want a mutual fund that says, you know, excuse me, we're going to wait until things are better before we put money in. Because you hear people say that all the time. You hear individual investors say, oh, I'm going to wait for it to get better. They wait for the market to go up 100%. And they go, oh, great, good time to invest. It may be, you know, they might be right, but the best time to invest is when it had gone down 50%. So here's dollar cost averaging. And I asked you to memorize this. I'm going to ask you to memorize it again. With dollar cost averaging, your average cost per share should be less than your average price per share. And that doesn't mean anything to you. But let's take a look at the example and see if it does. You have 3 years where you put in $1,000 in at the beginning of every year. The first year, the price was $10. So you bought 100 shares, right? $1,000, $10 a share, 100 shares. Got it? The second year, the price has gone down to $5. You've lost 50%. But you listen to your financial advisor who told you, no, you got to keep putting money in. So you put in $1,000 at $5, and you now have 200 shares that you've purchased, and you have a total of 300 shares. Right? Nod your head yes. Now, the third year, the price has gone from $5 to $7.50. So you take $1,000 divided by $7.50, and you have 133.333 shares. So it looks, if you just look at the average price, it looks as though you've broken even, right? You bought at $10, $5, and $7.50. So the average price was $7.50. But because you bought fewer shares when the price was higher, more shares when the price was lower, your average cost per share was only $6.92. Your average cost per share is lower than your average price per share. Now, is that a guarantee? If it kept falling, I'm buying more shares. It's not a guarantee. But instead of just breaking even and having $3,000, you actually have $3,250. You understand? So when the market falls, should you go, oh, should you be really upset?
No.
No. Unless you believe that the whole thing's going to crack, fall, and we're going to be left with nothing. And there's no food at the gas station, no food at the grocery store, no gas at the gas station, no clothes at the mall, the cell phones aren't working, the trash isn't being picked up, SDG&E isn't pumping out electricity, the schools, the hospitals. In a bit, right? But this is what's going to happen. There are going to be times when, you know, you just sort of... Are you with me?
Yeah.
But do you have a long-term perspective? Okay. By always investing the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the price is low and fewer shares when the price is high. I want you to memorize this so you can say it to people and not get tripped up, and they won't understand what you're talking about, but you'll sound really intelligent. Your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. However, it is not a guarantee of success. It ain't going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. You'll just keep losing more money. But it does make investing very, very easy. Are you worried about when the best time to invest is?
No.
You're putting $50 a month, $100 a month, and for most of us working grunts, it's the only way we're ever going to invest. When is $50,000 going to fall in your lap? Tomorrow? Good for you. Glad to hear it. It makes it very easy for mutual funds investors, that is, because for $50 you can buy however many shares of mutual funds. It's a little harder with stocks and a whole lot harder with bonds. How much do you realistically need to buy a stock? I tell people about 500-600. Maybe a little bit more. But that's only one stock, right? And then you got to buy 10, 20 or so. Bonds, you need $1,000 just to buy one bond. And unless it's at treasurydirect.gov, the bond dealers kind of look at you and go, yeah, get out of here. We want a $25,000 minimum. Arithmetic, right? Remember that? Okay. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds? And the other one is? Professional money management. But does that mean that mutual funds necessarily have less risk than individual portfolios? Well, it all depends on which mutual funds you're talking about. And so your assignment, which is pretty straightforward, not as easy as Chapter 18, but it's pretty easy, is to go look up some mutual funds. And I gave you some companies and mutual funds that I like, but it's very simple. You go to Yahoo or Morningstar or anyone you want to go to and type in one of your favorite businesses, one of my favorite mutual funds, and then over here is risk. And you will see, and in fact, I think they now have the upside down. No, they don't. The Morningstar has even more data. But here we see, let's look at the 10-year. And I ask you to look up what alpha, beta, kappa, gamma, all of those, and alpha, beta. There's the correlation coefficient, R squared it's called. But look at the standard deviation. The standard deviation for the category that this mutual fund invests is part of, large cap, American, United States companies, over the last 10 years was 15%, up or down 15%. These guys, it was 13.5%. So they had less risk as measured by standard deviation, which is an imperfect measurement. Questions? I like this mutual fund. Does that mean you should buy? No. I'm just saying, look at some of the mutual funds that you're interested in. I got, dozens of links up. Not dozens, but just plenty of them. And then if you go to Morningstar, I wrote that down, right? Morningstar now gives you the upside and downside capture ratio, which is very cool. If we have more time, I'll show it to you. I love that upside-downside ratio. And more this data is becoming popular. Many market historians have observed the tendency of mutual fund investors to get in at the top, the inflows, get the inflows in the mutual funds go high when the market's really doing well, right before it's about ready to crash. And then when it's crashing, mutual fund outflows. So here we are. Okay. See the blue things? These are inflows into mutual funds, stock mutual funds. The green ones are outflows. That's people taking money out. So in 1994... people put in $125 billion into stock mutual funds. And, oh, it's 93, I'm sorry. And they took out, I mean, they didn't take out, they put in $70 billion into bond funds. The next year, when bonds did poorly in 1994, they took out $60 billion out of bond funds. That was the worst time to do it because the bond market had fallen. That would have been the time to be putting money in because interest rates rose, bond prices fell. That was the time to buy bonds. And yet, what did people do? They sold. In 1999, here was 2000, that's probably the best example. In 2000, people put in a total of $310 billion worth of money into stock mutual funds at the height of the bubble, and they sold bonds, $50 billion, in anticipation of the next decade when bonds would crush stocks, when bonds would do a whole lot better than stocks. You understand? Or am I going? Some of you are just going. And then the same thing happened here. in 2008, the time you should have been buying, people took out a total of almost $250 billion out of stock funds. And every year until 2011, they took money out of stocks. At the very time that the stock market is staging one of the biggest rebounds,
this is why I love politics, you know. Poly means many, ticks are blood-sucking insects, right?
They hate Obama. The Republicans and the business people, they hate him, they hate him, they hate him. He's been one of the best presidents for the stock market in the world. But is it his? What?
Many, and then blood-sucking.
Yeah, many blood-sucking insects. Like poly ticks, many blood-sucking insects. Now, is it his fault? Is it his...
No,
it's just because it did so poorly before him. Now, you could say that part of it was Bush's fault, but it was also, there was a lot of fault to go around. Everybody was at fault. Everybody who believed that the house prices would continue to go up and up. And at the same time, they, look at that, over $350 billion into bond funds. When interest rates are low and bond prices are, you understand? That's why people like Warren Buffett are contrarians. And there are market historians and market analysts that watch these figures and suggest that you do the opposite of what most mutual fund investors are doing. And there's an old saying in the industry that mutual fund investors do worse than the mutual funds they invest in, and it's been proven to be true now, because they wait until the market bottoms before they take their money out. And they wait until the market tops before they put their money in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are. I'm sure. In fact, many will tell you that we're value-oriented contrarians. Yes, we try to sell into strength, and we try to buy when there's a.
Where are we at right now?
My understanding is that you have to go to ICI.org, the motherlode. But my understanding is that stock mutual fund inflows are starting to pick up. They're not, they're not what they were back in the late 90s, but they're starting to come back. In that, probably in 2012, which the data is probably there, it'll be there. Their annual report comes out first week in May or so. It'll probably be up for 2012, but not by much. Not by much.
Yeah. So you need to check if they're, like, how well they did during the 2008 crisis.
How well? Who did?
The contrarian.
Well, the contrarians. I told you about Warren Buffett, right?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Well, yeah,
but that's the example. That's the example we use. And that's why, it's hard to be a contrarian. Because if you're always selling when the market goes up, you're going to very, very soon run out of money. Because the market goes up for every 3 years that it goes down. Now, it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, down, 1, 2, 3, down. Wouldn't it be great if it did that? It doesn't do it that way. But that's why people like him are very well willing to sit on their hands and wait for disaster to strike with tons of cash and then swoop in. Now, you and I, it's just not something that we can really pull off easily. We're trying to live our lives, putting our $50, $100 a month away while we slap the kids and keep the house from falling down. But I remember another quote I used back in chapter 5. It's not a steady business. That was Howard Kaplan of Oak Tree Capital. It's not a steady business. You have to be willing to just sit back and let the world do its thing until you see the market go way up, and then you say, okay, time to sell. And until you see the market go way down, okay, time to swoop in. But yeah, I would love to see you go find some contrarian mutual funds. There's actually a very famous Fidelity fund called the Contra Fund. But this guy really isn't a contrarian. He's a very good investor. So take a look at the Contra Fund, and you'll see that he's actually a growth-oriented investor. He's not a contrarian. But he's good, don't get me wrong. Okay, and that is chapter 11. And so, we have tied it all together, and I hope it made sense, and you're waking up again. Yeah?
Yeah.
I used to have this MP3 file that was crickets. It would play it every once in a while. Okay. So now, let's take a quick look at some illustrations. Here are bonds in retirement. This is a bond fund. That's been around for a long period of time. And what are we doing? Let's say you've made it to retirement, and it's time for you to sit back and kick back, and you've got $200,000 in your 401k. And so what you do is you put this into a bond fund.
But how is this, you know, your day of retirement?
It's 20 years ago. And what you're going to do is you're going to start with the magic number. The magic number is supposedly 4%. If you take out 4% a year and then increase that with inflation, and what I do, I raise it 3% every year. So whatever I took out, 4%, I raise that 3%. That doesn't mean it goes 4, 7, 10, 13. No. It's whatever it was, 4%, and then I made a little bit of raise on top of that, 3% raise on that. So in other words, with inflation. So the first year, now we're starting in the, we're starting on April 1st, 1993. The first year we only take $6,000 out because it's 3/4 of a year. But the value actually went up. And then, because you went with bonds, you were unlucky enough to get hit by 1994, one of the few years the bonds actually went down. But you see them start to come back, and our value is growing. Why? Because bonds are returning 6-7% over time, hopefully. Some bond funds have done better. And we're also noticing our withdrawals are increasing. Why? Because inflation is going up and we want our income to increase, even in retirement. This is the death knell for retirees who are on a fixed amount every month. And it never changes? Do prices stop going up just because you retired? No. So we set it up so that a system will automatically give us more money every year. And so at the end of 20 years, and notice we got hit by 2008 pretty hard. We went from 225 down to 185. But until then, our nest egg has been, you know, rising slowly, not big, but it's coming back. We've taken out $230,000 and our nest egg is down to 193. You understand? And we've returned almost 6%, 5.5%. Now that's somebody on a bond portfolio in retirement. Questions, thoughts? That's what happened the last 20 years. Is that going to happen in the next 20 years? We don't know. I don't think so. I think bonds are probably going to return at least 1% less. I'd be surprised if we didn't get a 4.5%, 5%. Maybe not 1% less. But I don't think bonds are going to do as well going forward the next 20 years. But I might be wrong. I don't know. That's my personal opinion. And now you can see you're really excited about that. Now, what happens if we decide to put it all into the stock market? Okay, here's all the scary part about be afraid, be very afraid. And we do the same thing. We say we're going to put $200,000 in, take 4% out every year, and then the next year, reevaluate it, add 3% of that 4%. And so we see our withdrawals going up. We see, 94, it went down a little bit. But we see it then do really well up until 2000, and we're at 444. Meanwhile, our withdrawals have been going up. And then the 2002, 2003, 2000 to 2002 bear market came in, and we saw it drop from 444 to 327. And because our principal dropped, our withdrawals dropped, because we recalculated every year. But then it comes back 2007, we're up to 447 again. Remember, we're taking money out every year. We're up to $24,000, $25,000 a year. And then whammo, we go from 447 to 274. Now, if you're in retirement, and you retired, 16 years ago or 15 years ago? Are you ready for that kind of drop?
No.
It might give you a heart attack, right? Because you're in your 70s or earlier.
I can't remember what happened.
Yeah, you might hear, but you're in dementia, doesn't matter.
Sure.
Okay, but did you hold on? Well, your income dropped. If you held on, you've made it back up to 360, and your income is now, that's just for the first 3 months of this year, but $23,000. Would you be willing to put up with that volatility in your retirement age? You still got almost 10%. But you had to put up with a whole lot more volatility, yes?
You could still keep drawing money out.
Oh, yeah, you're still going to be drawing it out. And look, you've withdrawn out $375,000. Over $100,000 more than what the bond investors withdrew. Plus, your nest egg is still higher than it. You know, it's still a lot, but not a whole lot higher, but it was $200,000 when you started, and now it's $360,000. Are you with me? Understand?
Yes.
Even through 2000 to 2002 to 2000 and 2008, 2009, even though you lived through those things, but did you? Were you able to hold on emotionally? Because there's an intellectual part of investing, and there's the emotional part of investing. And you're in your elder years. Are you willing to put up with that volatility? You know, I try my best to make it exciting and interesting. And you got, at least you can do is look like you're interested. Okay? Try to at least look like you're interested. Because that makes me feel better. And now, we blend the two. We take $100,000 put in stocks, $100,000 put in bonds. Balance, right? And I didn't use a balance fund. I just put the two funds that we looked at, but put $100,000 in one and $100,000 in another. And did the same thing. 4% the first year, and then down from there. And what we see is a little bit of volatility in 94, and then going up, back up. Our withdrawals are going up. And look at where's 2000. Here, 2000, we've hit 332. But notice that the downturn was not as spectacular. We lost, what, 75,000 the last time? Here we've lost about 50. No, we lost more than that the last time. This is about 55,000. We lost more than 75. I forget how much it was. But the downturn between 2000 and 2002 was far less. And then we hit our peak at 2007, and instead of losing almost 200,000, we've only lost about $100,000, and then we're coming back up. Now our nest egg is not as what it was with the all stocks, but our withdrawal is in between the two, not as low as it was with stocks or with bonds, not as high as it was with stocks, and the volatility was less, and we've gotten a return of 8%. Okay. Yes, thank you. I remember one guy talking about teaching. He said, you know, I'm kind of insecure, and I really don't like it when the students just look at me like, I'm bored. I don't want to be here. But don't be a teacher, right? But I love it. I love it. Can I say? And so everybody who wasn't here on Tuesday, did you get the Baffle the Broker? Did you pass around all the Baffle the Brokers who weren't on Tuesday? Two more. Okay, make sure you get a Baffle the Broker. Okay, so what am I doing? Okay. Oh, let's turn the light on. Let's turn the light on. So here we are, folks. Yeah, who didn't get a Baffle the Broker? On Tuesday, we will be doing the bond calculation. So make sure you can do worksheets number 1 and 2. And if you want to do those, we'll stick around. Those of you who want to do 1 or 2 of those, we'll stick around after class. Tuesday, 30th of April, chapters 9 and 10. Maybe 1 or 2 questions on 18. What is a convertible security? And then the correlation, imperfect correlation, is why it works to diversify. Positive correlation, they all move in the same way. Negative, they move in opposite. And then the asset allocation, rebalancing, the stuff we discussed today. Dollar cost averaging, memorize it. What's the saying when you tell people, they ask you, why do you do dollar cost averaging? You say, you don't remember. Because your average cost per share will be less than your average price per share. Is it a guarantee?
No.
No. Okay. And then, what I also want you to do is be able to do the constant perpetual growth model. and the discounted cash flow model. And some of you are like, Payana, why are we doing this again? Because there's some people who still can't do it. And if there's one thing you're going to be able to do before you leave this class in May, you're going to be able to do the constant perpetual growth model and the discounted cash flow model. And this is this stock, folks. This, some people ask me who was the best investment I ever made. And here it is. Actually, it wasn't this company because it wasn't around when I bought it. But have you ever heard of Philip Morris? You've heard of Philip Morris? What do they make? Marlboro! Virginia Dims. What? Okay. Benson? No, they make Benson. What? R.J. Reynolds and British American Tobacco. And who else? There's another one. Low. No. Forget the other one. They're pretty small. No, there are a few. You know, if you've been to France, and they have these jetons, like this big, there's no filter, and the French will smoke it down to a this big, I don't know how the hell they do it. You think it would burn their lips, but they smoke it down to a that big. You have it in your mouth. What? I don't know. All right, so. What?
Yeah, right.
No, I don't know. I always use the pipe. My brother could roll really good joints, and I could never do it. I couldn't do it. I just gave up. And I said, how do you do it? He goes, you got to put up with your bad joints. And I never liked it. I'll tell you the truth. You won't believe me, but I hated it. It made me paranoid. I couldn't find my foot. It was really. And I got my Century Pass a few years ago, and the woman there, you had to get through an interview, and she said, now, have you ever used any illegal drugs for recreation? I looked at her, I said, I went to college. And she laughed. That was a million years ago. I went to college. So I remember being at a party and thinking, I got to get up. I got to get out of here. I can't find my foot. What? Unlawful. Illegal drugs. Any illegal drugs. Illegal is a sick bird. There's a thing of illegal. Okay, so Philip Morris International was spun off from Altria, which used to be called Philip Morris, and is responsible for the cigarette sales outside the United States. So here's a company that's based in the United States and doesn't sell anything inside the United States. Everything is... What? You know, I've often thought about why they did that. And I think the reason they did that is because cigarette sales in the United States for many decades have been shrinking. Now they sort of plateaued at the bottom and they've sort of ticked back up again because the younger folks are smoking again because they want to be different just like everybody else. And their parents. I've told some of you, I love to mess with people's minds. I go up to some students who are young and beautiful and they're smoking. I say, oh, it's so sad. You're young and beautiful and you're smoking. And they look at me like, I need to carry out fire. But please, continue to smoke. I own stock in Philip Morris. Wow. And then they look at you like, well, you want me to die? You're the idiot who's putting the cancer stick in your mouth, sweetheart. Nobody's putting a gun to your head to make you do it. And you go, this is the only company in the world, not the only company, the only industry in the world that, when used as directed, kills their consumers. That's why they got to get them when they're 12, right? Because once they're 18, 20, they're too smart. I'm going to put that thing in their mouth. Yes, that they got rid of the gum cigarettes. Yeah. So here they are, folks. So I think what happened is they said, let's spin off the international because people around the world still see the Marlboro Man. We don't see the Marlboro Man anymore. But everybody around, he's dead. He remember the ones, I missed my lung, Bob. He's talking on the cell phone. And his horse, I missed my lung, Bob. But around the world, they all think, here in California, we wear our hats, and we ride our horses, and we rope cattle and smoke cigarettes. That's the image they show, right. And so I think they spun it off to unlock that growth, because the growth is not in the United States, it's outside the United States. See, we import shoes and cars and stupid chachkas that people buy, Ginsu knives and stuff. And what do we export? Ciggies!
and McDougal, McMurderers, and Kentucky Fried Rat.
Yeah.
Okay, so their current stock price is $94.50. Now, since 2008, folks, their dividends have been increasing at 12%. Dividends have been increasing at 12%. Now, do you think that's going to continue? I don't know, but that's what they've been doing. And so we expect their dividends for the next 3 years to be $3.40 for 2013, $3.80 for 2014, and 2015, $4.30. And we looked at Value Line, and they think that this stock should be $150 at the end of 2015. So, what models do we use to value this stock, assuming we are looking for a 12% return on our investment? Well, there's two of them we could use, right? Discounted cash flow and the constant perpetual growth model. Right. The constant, what a dumb name, but that's what they call it. And because they've been growing their dividends at 12%. So do you remember which one you want to do first? The discounted cash flow or the constant perpetual? Constant perpetual is annual dividends times 1 plus the dividend growth rate. Does this look familiar? Divided by our required rate of return minus the dividend growth rate. Okay. So what's the annual dividends?
12%.
The annual dividends are? They're growing at 12%, but what are the annual? So far, right now, they're doing $3.40. Now, what's the dividend growth rate?
12%.
So you multiply it times 1 plus 12%, which is 0.12. 1 plus that is 1.12. Right? And then you divide it by 12% minus 12%. So 0.12 minus 0.12. Okay, so what's this? $3.40 times 1.12? Calculator fans? What an excited class. Motivated students. Happy. $4.52. Divided by 0.12 to minus 0.12?
Zero.
So this stock is worth?
4.52.
Try to divide 4.52 divided by zero. What do you get? The stock is worth infinity.
That's awesome.
It's worth error, right. So what do we have to do? We have to raise our required rate of return. Because the model destroys itself if the required rate of return is equal to our expected rate of return. So we should really be expecting 13, 14, 15% from Philip Morris International. Now, what do we know about a stock that returns 14, 15, 15%? They're darn risky, aren't they? Normally. But are people going to stop smoking cigarettes?
Hell no.
So do you think this is one of the risky stocks out there that's returning 14, 15%? Okay, now, discounted cash flow model. Here are the future cash flows. Now, we don't know if this is going to happen. We're just assuming they're going to continue to raise their dividend for the years. At 12%, what are the present value multipliers for 12%? And if you haven't learned how to do this, please learn how to do it for Tuesday. Please, it's bad for my self-esteem. What? But the final, it's going to be on the final, too. Okay, so what are the present value multipliers for 12%, for 1, 2, and 3 years?
0.893. 0.797. 0.712.
Okay, so multiply $3.40 times 0.893,
$2.80, 0.797. And then add these two together, gives you 154.30 times 712. And then,
I think you passed it. I think you're looking for
the other one will work.
The other one will work. It's just the one on the right hand side. This is the same table. That table right there. So what'd you get?
The first one is 3.0362. Second is 3.0286. 109.8616. Total is
115.92. The stock is selling for $94.50, and we believe it's worth $115.92. Is it a good buy? You happy with 12%? It's actually turning better. Now, would you buy Philip Morris?
Hell yeah.
Would you? Would you buy Philip Morris? He started, I think, at 18 months. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for the first 12 years of his life. Okay. On Tuesday, be awesome. Make sure you can do the constant perpetual, the discounted cash flow. Is he inhaling? Look, what? Is he inhaling? Sure he is. He's inhaling. And bomb calculations. Study hard. Do a good job. And I want you all to do great.